Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Today, amidst civil war, slavery was outlawed in the USA in 1862. And today is the 149th anniversary of Custer's last stand in 1876. Multitudes of North American natives celebrate. Today is also the anniversary of the executions of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg in 1953, convicted of releasing the USA's nuclear secrets to Soviet Russia in the early days of the infamous Cold War. And today is also Juneteenth. And now I would like to read something I wrote for my defunct newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle. Stardust. We burst out of our egg into a history infinitely larger than our own, flung out among rocks and stars that hurtle away from the center of a cataclysm at speeds greater than light. Our Earth is a mote from that moment of creation, if indeed that is how the universe began, and it continues to be thrown back to God knows where. We might never know, but we will exhaust the rest of our history attempting to find out. It is doubtful that we will more than scratch a few score of the billion stars in our single galaxy before evolution discards us for something else, or we quicken the process by our own perverse ingenuity. We pursue the exploration of space in much the manner our European ancestors forced themselves upon the larger world, in fierce competition as merchants and soldiers from separate nations in perpetual conflict. We are a species of insatiable plunderers, though of course we tell ourselves that we are not, that we seek mainly knowledge. But our great hunger is for wealth and for what is useful to us. Unless we experience a mass epiphany overnight, we will most likely behave the same as our predecessors. We will pillage planets and hammer and smash space matter until it is functional to us. We have virtually sucked Earth dry, and our vision of the universe is of one huge orchard of riches. We cover our own planet like maggots on a peach. Our atomic structure is collapsing, and internal combustion resulting from the compost of our restless numbers. We are perilously close to extinction by our own industry. Not so long ago, we were savages, tormented by our ignorance of the strange world that was our home. We have not evolved particularly much, except that our savagery is more muscular. We have the power to crack the earth. Our situation as a result of possessing this power is desperate. If we cannot contain its power over us, Earth will probably nova. Our prospects are the stuff of cheap science fiction. Our only hope might be to send some seedlings off the home planet so that some might survive the long nuclear winter and perhaps repopulate the incubator when it stops glowing or germinate someplace else, if in all the vast cosmos we repeat the old errors. We do not leave Earth as members of a single bioplasm, but as relentless opponents. If it was absurd for Europeans to spread across Earth's oceans and claim foreign lands for kings and countries never heard of by the inhabitants of the far shores, How much more so for space-suited humans to plant flags on barren worlds and say that they belong in perpetuity to small parts of a speck, indistinguishable, if even visible, among the lights of space. We should not get starry-eyed about the professed manifest destiny of our own nation and its parochial space program. Many of the planned shuttle flights were to be secret military missions, primarily to do with Star Wars. And we should be cautious about the elevation of the seven dead explorers into mythical figures. We should not allow them to be so wrapped in the flag that it is considered unpatriotic to question the circumstances that killed them. Their deaths might help save humanity. The failure of the technology that was to propel them into space failed at the critical moment. The merely technical questions pale before the major one of depending upon the same systems that threaten us with oblivion to save us. Efficiency must give way to poetry. No machine or computer can view the Earth with the same personal response as a human. Earth is, after all, our neighborhood, our nest. It will not be our technology which saves us, but our distinct human perceptions. And perhaps it might be worth remembering that it is not our divine right to eat the Milky Way. And that was something I wrote a few years back, which might seem rather obscure, but it is not. And now, from an old friend, Norman Solomon. Democratic Party leaders just met for the first time in months. When will they take real action? And a subhead. Countless Americans want the party leadership to stand up for democracy. Instead, the executive committee remains in a bubble. People with the power to change the direction of the Democratic Party, the executive committee of the Democratic National Committee, met recently for the first time in months. They took no action. The party's bylaws make the executive committee, quote, responsible for the conduct of the affairs of the Democratic Party, unquote, between the meetings of the full committee, which is not scheduled to gather until late August. But taking responsibility was not on the agenda. Instead, the committee members and staff kept praising each other and committee leaders. Many talked about improving the party's infrastructure and vowed to defeat Republicans. Deliberation, proposals, and debate were completely absent. So was a sense of urgency. After so many months without a meeting, you might think that the executive committee would have a lot to talk about, but it was scheduled to meet for only 3 hours, which turned out to be more than adequate for what anyone had to say. The committee adjourned after an hour and a half. If obscurity was a goal for the national meeting held in Little Rock, Arkansas, it was a success. The DNC's website did not mention the meeting. Media coverage was close to non-existent. The committee leadership remains largely within a bubble, insulated from the anger and disgust toward the party that is widespread among countless Democrats and other Americans. They want the Democratic Party to really put up a fight, while its leaders mainly talk about putting up a fight. The Trump regime is setting basic structures of democracy on fire, while Democratic leaders don't seem to be doing much more than wielding squirt guns. Recently, the new chair, Ken Martin, received a petition calling for an emergency meeting of the full 448-member committee. The petition, co-sponsored by Progressive Democrats of America and Roots Action, where I'm national director, includes more than 1,500 individual comments. They are often filled with anguish and rage. The California representative, Ro Khanna, has joined in the call for an emergency committee meeting. I have supported it. I have spoken directly to our chair, Ken Martin, about it, Khanna said last week. Look, what's going on is chilling. They are banning all international students from coming to Harvard. I mean, think about that. All foreign students banned. They could do this in other universities. They have fired or let go 7 of the 18 directors at the NIH, totally dismantling future medical research in our country. They have dismantled the FDA, firing people who approve new drugs. They are systematically firing people at the FFA. They are openly talking about defying United States Supreme Court orders. J.D. Vance has said, just defying these orders. They're calling universities the enemy. This is very chilling. And that's a quote. Khanna then zeroed in on a crucial point that party leaders have so far refused to acknowledge, much less heed. It's not enough for us to have individual responses. I am out there doing my town halls in red districts. Bernie Sanders is inspiring the country with his oligarchy tour, but they are all individual efforts. We need concerted effort. We need a battle plan. And that's what an emergency DNC meeting would do. It would acknowledge the stakes and it would say, here is our plan to make sure that they are not degrading and chipping away at every institution of American democracy. Refusal to call an emergency meeting is a marker of deeper problems with Democratic Party leadership remaining in a political rut, spouting mildly liberal rhetoric while serving the interests of big donors, high-paid consultants, and entrenched power brokers. Along the way, such business as usual is a gift that keeps on giving power to the pseudo-populist messages of MAGA Republican politicians. No wonder the Democratic Party has lost most of the working class vote. With no Democrat in the White House, the DNC chair is powerful. To his credit, Martin talks articulately about the need to democratize this party. And that's a quote. 4 months into the job previously held by Jamie Harrison, who was Joe Biden's obedient appointee, Martin is clearly an improvement. How much of an improvement is unclear. After the DNC's executive committee adjourned, Martin provided a glimmer of hope for ending the chokehold that mega funders, notably AIPAC, have exerted on recent primary campaigns. He was interviewed by my colleague, Sam Rosenthal, covering the event for Progressive Hub and apparently the only journalist based outside of Arkansas to make the trek to Little Rock. In response to a question about whether he would like to see less influence from dark money, removing the influence especially in Democratic Party primaries, quote unquote, Martin said, again a quote, yes. In fact, I will be bringing forward a resolution on that, and I will be pushing hard for our party to come up with solutions on this so that we actually have our candidates and campaigns realize that we have to live our values. We can't just say we want dark money out of politics and then have candidates and their campaigns accepting all types of support from these shadow groups. We actually need to reverse course. That reply might indicate that Martin is now willing to move away from the position that he took while running for DNC chair in January, when he said, "There are a lot of good billionaires out there that have been with Democrats who share our values, and we will take their money, but we are not taking money from those bad billionaires," quote, unquote. With June underway, the Democratic Party is no closer to operating with urgency to vigorously oppose the daily Trump attacks on basic rights, the rule of law, and the economic interests of most Americans. The party's terrible approval ratings in polls, with disdain for its congressional leaders, make the need for drastic changes in the party all too clear. But when the DNC and allied party organizations do outreach urging people to get involved, routinely the only involvement urged or offered is to give money. It's a formulaic approach that reveals just how little the National Party is really seeking participatory democracy. Millions of usual and all too often former Democratic voters see party leaders as asleep at the switch while the Trump regime is hard at work enriching the already rich and demolishing structures of democracy. As usual, if genuine change for the better is going to come, it won't be handed down from on high. People at the grassroots will have to fight for it. And that was Democratic Party leaders just met for the first time in months. When will they take real action? And it was written by Norman Solomon. He attended Portland State University late last millennium and was a friend of mine whom I admire and respect. And now, also from The Guardian, Trump's tax bill helps the rich, hurts the poor, and adds trillions to the deficit. And it's by Katrina Vandenhoevel. The blush is off the rose, or rather the orange. The erstwhile first buddy and born-again fiscal hawk, Elon Musk, recently said he was disappointed by Donald Trump's spendthrift budget currently under debate in the U.S. Senate. Squeaking through the House of Representatives, thanks to the capitulation of several Republican deficit hardliners, this, quote, big, beautiful bill, unquote, certainly increases the federal debt bigly by nearly $4 trillion over the next decade. Equally disappointed are those who have been busy burnishing Trump's populist veneer. Steve Bannon had repeatedly promised higher taxes for millionaires, but he has confessed he's very upset. That's because the bill would cut taxes by over $600 billion for the top 1% of wage earners, also known as millionaires. It amounts to the largest upward transfer of wealth in American history. Yet this double betrayal will do nothing to impede the sundry MAGA apparatchiks' breathless support for their dear leader. Musk has already tweeted his gratitude to the president for the opportunity to lead DOGE, that is, slash funding for cancer research. And for Trump, it has reaffirmed that his pledged golden age is really just a windfall for the uber-wealthy like him. Now there can be no mistaking that Republicans' governing philosophy is neither conservatism nor populism, but unabashed hypocrisy. Expecting the self-proclaimed king of debt to balance the budget, or hoping workers would be protected by the billionaire whose personal motto is, "You are fired," was always imaginative thinking at best. In his first term, Trump added $8 trillion to the national deficit. Even excluding COVID relief spending, that's twice as much debt as Joe Biden racked up during his 4 years in the White House. Almost $2 trillion of that tab came from Trump's vaunted tax cut, which delivered three times more wealth to the top 5% of wage earners than it did to the bottom 60%. Nor did its benefits trickle down, with incomes remaining flat for workers who earn less than $114,000. Trump's disingenuousness on the deficit continues a hallowed Republican tradition. All four Republican presidents since 1980 have increased the federal debt by combining reckless militarism with rampant corporatism. George W. Bush managed to balloon it by 1,204%. When Bush's Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill expressed concern about that spending, Dick Cheney, the then vice president, reportedly retorted, "Deficits don't matter," quote unquote. Except, of course, when a Democrat occupies the Oval Office. During his campaign for the U.S. Senate in 2022, J.D. Vance derided Biden's signature $1 trillion infrastructure package as a huge mistake that would waste money on really crazy stuff, like improving almost 200,000 miles of roads and repairing over 11,000 bridges across the country. Apparently less crazy, but certainly more callous, are the vertiginous cuts to the social safety net proposed in Trump's current budget bill. Its $1 trillion evisceration of Medicaid and SNAP would leave 8 million Americans uninsured and potentially in food assistance for 11 million people, including 4 million children. When the Democratic representative, Ro Khanna, introduced an amendment to maintain coverage for the 38 million kids who receive their health care through Medicaid, Republicans blocked it from even receiving a vote. But for all the budget's austerity, it also provides $20 billion in tax credits to establish a national school voucher program, and equally outrageous are its provisions that have nothing to do with the pecuniary, from easing regulations on gun silencers to hamstringing the power of courts to enforce injunctions. Perhaps most breathtaking of all, though, is how shamelessly the bill enriches the already mega rich. In its first year, its tax breaks will grace Americans in the top 0.1% of the income bracket with an additional $400,000, while decreasing the earnings of people in the bottom 25% by $1,000. In other words, those who can least afford it are financing relief for those who least need it. When the 50% of working class Americans who broke for Trump in last year's election realize they voted for a pay cut, they might begin to feel a bit disillusioned with the crypto trader in chief. They might even feel pulled to the authentically populist vision outlined by the progressive Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on their nationwide Fighting Oligarchy tour. In the meantime, it is almost an inevitability that Republican senators will wring their hands before pressing the green button to vote yay. Josh Hawley has called the budget bill morally wrong and politically suicidal, quote unquote. Criticism which Trump has previously mocked as grandstanding. The insult contains a typically Trumpian flash of psychological insight, because Hawley and his colleagues will no doubt do exactly what their counterparts in the House have already done. Cave. Once Trump has scribbled his oversized signature onto the bill, his vision for the U.S. will become unmistakable. Try as they might, not even the spinmeisters at Fox News will be able to deny that he runs this country the way he ran his Atlantic City casinos, leading working Americans to financial ruin while he emerges all the richer for it. And that was by Katrina Vanden Heuvel. Trump's tax bill helps the rich, hurts the poor, and adds trillions to the deficit. She is editorial director and publisher of The Nation, a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and a contributor to The Washington Post, The New York Times, and The Los Angeles Times. This is Michael McCusker. Joanne Rideout is engineer of this program. If anyone should be tried for treason in the USA, it is Donald Trump, whose initial attempt to overthrow liberty and democracy for all was based on absolute falsifications. He is, after all, a consummate liar, and the baldly despotic intent to undermine the election he lost by a majority vote of American citizens. And he blatantly disavowed the peaceful exchange of power that distinguishes democracy from autocracy. Do not forget that Trump used his wealth to shield himself from military service in the Vietnam War, and that his political career has been corrupt and shadily Hitleresque. Democracy is always under threat to be undermined. The history of human rights is murky and always under threat by humans who strive for only their own rights and power. In the words of Robert Heinlein, while eternity is long, time is short.